the Manhattan Project, in a sense, has affected the whole history of warfare in building a bomb which ultimately threatens the future of humanity.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to The Corbett Report. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is currently, as I am recording this, the last day of April 2024, and we are joined today by a regular, longtime guest of The Corbett Report, friend of the show. I'm talking, of course, about Michelle Chosadowski of Global Research at globalresearch.ca. And if you are unfamiliar with globalresearch.ca, I would be very surprised at that, but this is a good time to familiarize yourself with the extensive, voluminous archive of information and news that is available there. And of course, you can check out our previous interviews over the years by typing Chosadowski into my search bar, but let's bring him on the program. Michelle Chosadowski, it's been a number of years, but it is very good to see you again today. Thank you for coming on.
Well, I'm delighted to be on the program, and we are at the crossroads of a very serious economic, social crisis characterized by war, impoverishment, very, very complex, and As you suggested, of course, nuclear war and our understanding of nuclear weapons is absolutely fundamental, because we don't want to some president of the United States to click on the wrong button. And that I think is very crucial at this stage, because the decisions with regard to the use of nuclear weapons is governed by artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence artificial intelligence is determined by individuals as to what the criteria are. So that is my concern today, is that the threat of nuclear war is definitely there. It's not something which we can neglect. And my understanding, after having researched this for the last 20 years, is that in the case of a nuclear war, even using the tactical nuclear weapons, the small mini bombs, we would have a process of escalation, which would ultimately lead to the destruction of humanity as we know it. There's a lot of literature on the nuclear winter and so on, radioactive fallout. But I think that in effect, the impacts would be devastating. And the decision makers, namely politicians primarily, but not necessarily only politicians, also business interests as well, are not knowledgeable as to these consequences. And I recall the statements of Hillary Clinton in relation to countries, to non-nuclear states: nuclear weapons is on the table. And I think it is on the table. People don't realize that the collateral damage of a nuclear war is humanity in its entirety.
Well, Michelle, I know you have been writing and researching this subject for decades, but let's frame today's conversation with a very specific thing that you wrote last February, but recently reposted to globalresearch.ca. It's called the Hiroshima-Nagasaki Dress Rehearsal: Oppenheimer and the U.S. War Department's Secret September 15th, 1945 Doomsday Blueprint to Wipe the Soviet Union Off the Map. And of course, I will direct people to that article in particular. If you need the link, it will be in the show notes for this episode. But let's talk about this article. Why did you write it last February? Why did you decide to repost that just recently?
Well, I actually had been working on this. There were previous versions, but the thing is that this changes one's understanding of history and the history of the Second World War. Now, let me mention a few things about the so-called Manhattan Project. Oppenheimer was in charge of the scientific analysis from his Los Alamos team, he was in contact with the War Department. Now, what happened, and I'm in a sense I'm giving the basics because it's very, very complex. In 1939, they established the Manhattan Project. It didn't come really active until about the mid-40s, okay? 1942 there. And I'm sorry, not the mid-40s, but the middle of World War II. Canada and the United Kingdom were partners in this project, although essentially it was dominated within the United States. For Canada, it was the fact that Canada has uranium. And so they invited Canada to come in. What happened is that they were working on an atomic bomb. It was Oppenheimer's project with a group of scientists. Incidentally, but that's another theme, the official version was that this was to counteract initiatives in Nazi Germany, and historians now have shown that there never was a decision to produce an atomic bomb in Nazi Germany. There were scientists. Well, Oppenheimer is in any event of German descent. But the thing is that they put together this project, and they then had the explosions on the 6th and the 8th or 9th, depending on the time zone, of August 1945. And there were two types of bombs. One was Hiroshima, which was based on uranium, and Nagasaki was plutonium. And almost immediately, in the wake of these two bombardments, which led to 100,000 deaths in Hiroshima and the total destruction of these cities. Okay, now I won't get into that, but it's all that is documented. The yield of these bombs is minimal in relation to the contemporary bombs. Okay, and even the Russians have bombs which are about 3,000 times a Hiroshima bomb. But what is important there is that barely a month later, and in fact, two weeks after the end of World War II, it was signed with the Japanese in the beginning of September. Then on September 15th, 1945, there was a plan, detailed plan. How do we know it? Because we can consult declassified documents. And those declassified documents show two things. First of all, there was a project to bomb the Soviet Union, 66 cities with 204 atomic bombs. Now, that was a project. But it was nonetheless a secret project of the War Department. And of course, it interfaced with the scientific team of Oppenheimer. Now, if you look at the geography of the Soviet Union, you're talking about a population at that time, plus or minus, something of the order of 200 million people. And that level of bombardment would literally have led to the annihilation of the Soviet Union, literally. So that we can't sort of dismiss this. It was a project, and it was a project which was formulated when the United States and Russia and Soviet Union were allies, and they collaborated, and they were meeting in Yalta and so on. To get down to your question about the dress rehearsal, this was a dress rehearsal because they then analyzed the, and we have all the documents on that, they analyzed Hiroshima and they analyzed Nagasaki and they determined based on various hypotheses and estimates and so on that to destroy a particular city with a particular population, you would need something of the order of three atomic bombs. It would be much higher for Moscow and Leningrad and so on, and Kiev. Now, all that was part of a project to essentially, I wouldn't characterize that as a crime against humanity, but it was a criminal intent. And it led, first of all, it led to, what is significant is that, of course, the Russians knew about it. Well, I say, of course, they did know there was earlier. It was not formulated in 1945. It was already being envisaged at an earlier stage. What came out in 1945 in September was the blueprint of a military operation. And they would say, well, they would say, well, we killed so many people in Hiroshima. We destroyed the whole landscape, was destroyed in a few minutes. And then they started simulating how they would formulate this project for the Soviet Union with these 66 cities. Now there were other similar estimates of bombing. Actually, went up to 1,200, and it included China and it included parts of Eastern Europe. I won't get into that, but the problem is the following: that the Manhattan Project, in a sense, has affected the whole history of warfare in building a bomb which ultimately threatens the future of humanity. And it also was conducive to the arms race, because had there not been a Manhattan Project, there would not have been, there possibly would be an arms race, but it wouldn't be for nuclear weapons. But the thing is that as a result of the Manhattan Project, we had a whole series of countries that developed nuclear weapons, but specifically Russia, which was based initially defensive. It was based on the notion during the Cold War of mutually assured destruction. That was the dogma. And also when there was the meetings between Kennedy and Khrushchev in the early 60s, it was understood that they should not use this bomb. Now, if we flash forward to today, we have a total ignorance by the decision makers as to what might happen in the case of the use of a nuclear bomb. And it's not covered by the media, and it's not covered in any kind of debate, let's say in the US Senate or the House of Representatives. And then, of course, Israel has the bomb as well. But Israel's bomb is essentially, it's a proxy of the Western technologies. They say that it's French and British, but in fact, it really the nuclear industry in Israel is a partnership between Israel and its close ally, which is the United States of America. So that's the background, I think my concern is that we don't. We are in a World War III scenario at this juncture. Now, where is that World War III scenario going to go? And what kind of weapon systems are they going to use? And now let me just say a couple more things about today's nuclear dogma. In the wake of the Cold War, the nuclear doctrine was redefined, but it was really redefined in the wake of 9/11 and the early post-Cold War period. They still considered the notion of mutually assured destruction. Now, in the wake of 9/11, there was a new doctrine which was put forth, which was what was called preemptive. Now, preemptive is saying we're developing nuclear weapons to defend ourselves. Self-defense. And the preemptive doctrine was largely formulated in relation to non-nuclear states. And it led to the creation of these so-called mini-nukes or tactical nuclear weapons. They're called tactical nuclear weapons and then mini-nukes, and then they have an explosion on the ground. And what happened is that the Nuclear Posture Review of 2001, which was published the following year in 2002, was predicated on this notion of using nuclear weapons as a means to defend yourself, as self-defense. And then they said, well, this bomb is safe for civilians because the explosion is underground, and it has low yield. In other words, its explosive capacity is minimal. And then they started formulating the notion of a peacemaking bomb. One can look at the military documents on that, but the peacemaking bomb doesn't make sense, because then they say, oh, it's a low intensity. It goes from 1/3 of a Hiroshima bomb in terms of intensity, explosive capacity, to 12 times a Hiroshima bomb. And that's a small mini nuke. And then let's say the dogma comes in saying, well, we know that that we have these big bombs, Russia has them, we have them, but we're not going to use them. And instead, we're going to develop these small bombs, and we will have our allies they're actually stationed in Europe, and they're delivered. They don't have an advanced delivery system. But in any event, what has happened is that the nature of this bomb has changed. The technology is identical, whether it's a tactical or whether it's a strategic nuclear bomb. But then they say, then they will change the label of the bomb. Now, I don't think you're smoking, but people who do smoke among our audience, it's like taking a pack of cigarettes and removing the label and saying smoking is good for your health. Well, that's exactly what they did. They said, here's our bomb, B6111, the more advanced version, B6112. We change the label, and they say this bomb is a peacemaking bomb. And you look at the military manuals, it's all there. So that is why we're at a very dangerous crossroads, because they could say, well, some of these bombs are harmless to civilians. And that's particularly when they're targeting Iran. They're thinking of those types of bombs. Now, that is the second phase. But then there's a third phase, which is very important to understand. And it happened 1 year later, following the publication of the Nuclear Posture Review of 2001. Well, it came out in 2002. In 2003, starting on the 6th of August, 2003, up to the 8th of August, local time, 2003, meeting at in Omaha, Nebraska, at the headquarters of Strategic Command headquarters. Okay, I think people are familiar with that. They had a meeting with the private sector. We don't have much information on this meeting. They were meeting behind closed doors, and this was there for the private sector military-industrial complex. Well, they're already semi-privatized as far as Pentagon is concerned. But they laid the groundwork for what was implemented a couple of years later at the outset of the Obama administration, when they came up with the it was the so-called $1 trillion nuclear weapons program. Now, $1 trillion is $1,000 billion. We're not talking about small numbers here. Budget, it's not an annual budget, but that budget has now increased to $1.3 trillion, and it is slated to go up to $2 trillion by 2030. So what has happened is that the US military-industrial complex are producing these mini nukes at a tremendous cost. You can imagine how many schools and hospitals you'll be able to build with $1 trillion, right? But that's the ball game. It's privatized. And it's not privatized necessarily to have the biggest bomb or the more, they're essentially producing bombs, these mini nukes. We're not really familiar with the details of this program, because when you're talking about $1 trillion, well, you have a whole series of entities involved in intelligence, the Pentagon, and so on, and scientific labs. But this indicates also the trend in the armament industry is that they have contracts for $1 trillion, and that $1 trillion. You can really do what you want with them and sell these mini nukes at a very high price. And the mini nukes are not, the mini nukes are standard technology, but you might have a mini nuke with a bit like a BMW car, okay? Where you, well, I wouldn't put it, maybe not a BMW, maybe a good Japanese car, where you have all different options as to regard to speed and intensity. If you wanted to have 12 times the Hiroshima bomb, you can look at the different options. But the thing is, here we have an industry of such magnitude that it obviously something at one point goes wrong. And with artificial intelligence, the possibilities of a nuclear holocaust are there, and people should understand it. Now, I'm telling you something very personal. I've written on various topics, and when I post an article on nuclear war, people don't like to read it. And I don't blame them. But the thing is, we need a movement. We need a broad anti-war movement, and we have to understand. Oh, that's another thing. Israel may be asked to do what Dick Cheney said many years ago, and it's on record. They said Israel might be doing the dirty work for us. That's still there. Israel has nuclear weapons. The Americans are not going to necessarily enter into an attack on Iran, but that industry is joint in a sense. But Israel may take, and they're already involved in doing the dirty work. And in fact, all the allies, the NATO allies, are doing the dirty work for the United States. So that's the background.
That is the background, and it's quite the background. But I would suggest that people do engage with this material, even though, as you say, it's understandable that people dislike reading these types of articles, but I think they are important. So I will direct them back to your article where you have all the detail of the historical scenario that you just painted there, including the, for example, declassified telephone conversations between Lieutenant General Leslie Groves, who was heading the Manhattan Project for the War Department, and Oppenheimer at Los Alamos, the correspondence between Groves and his superiors in the War Department, etc., etc., all of that background. You also have information on the subsequent plans that were devised in the bowels of the Pentagon, the 1949 drop shot, which envisaged using not only 300 nuclear bombs, but also 20,000 tons of conventional bombs on 200 targets in 100 urban areas in the Soviet Union, which was subsequently updated in 1956 with a new Strategic Air Command Atomic Weapons Requirements Study, which talked, as you say, about over 1,200 cities being targeted. And that only developed from there. And the development of all of that, as you say, is listed here. But I want to circle back to some of that World War II history that I think is relevant in this regard. I would like you to speak to the hypocrisy of the people who would presume to sit in judgment of their vanquished enemies at Nuremberg, at the Tokyo trials, for the very crimes that they themselves are demonstrably on the record were engaged in. For example, the crime against peace, which was the fundamental charge that was required, for example, at the Tokyo trial for anyone to be tried there, which not only included actively waging a war of aggression, but planning for the waging of such a war, and, of course, such crimes as genocide, which, obviously, the 1956 doctrine of nuking 1,200 cities obviously qualifies as genocide. Can you speak to that hypocrisy?
Well, you know, I have reviewed the history of warfare, and I think that genocide has been built into every single war. It was built into World War II, and it is also, now we are living genocide. Now, this may be a diversion from the theme of the nuclear weapons, but I have more recently, I've looked at the genocide in Palestine, which is corroborated, irrespective of what the tribunal will say. Well, the tribunal is totally corrupt because it's controlled by a legal advisor to Hillary Clinton, okay, who's the president of the Court of Justice. But bear in mind that not only do we have a genocide in Palestine, we've had genocides in all the wars that the U.S. has led. Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, etc. But there's another element. The US-NATO alliance, and they're now sending troops to Ukraine, they are supportive of a coalition government which is dominated by two Nazi parties. Now, it's not to say that the whole government is, well, the government is a proxy government. But the thing is, now we've seen this distribution of funds from the House of Representatives, which will be approved by the Senate, of something of the order of $60 billion to Ukraine. And those two parties, they are involved, they were involved in the Holocaust. And it's documented. It's not, they're not separate, they're not new, they're not new. They were involved in the Holocaust. And I've gone through a whole bunch of documents pointing to the fact that the organization of Ukrainian nationalism, collaborated actively with Nazi Germany right from the beginning, from Operation Barbarossa onwards, right until 1944, throughout Ukraine. And in the case of Lvov, which is a city on the border with Poland, and it's in Ukraine now, but it was in Poland previously, that city had a population of 160,000 Jews, and the Ukrainian nationalists were entrusted with literally killing them and moving them to concentration camps and extermination. It's all on record. Now, when the NATO member states say we are helping Ukraine to fight Russia, but they don't mention the fact that the people with whom they're dealing are the people who actually were supportive of the Holocaust during the occupation period of Nazi Germany. So there we have another element. It's important because Germany, it's illegal to be a Nazi, okay? It's illegal. But it's also illegal for a government to transact with parties which were involved in the Holocaust. So there's an issue, because there you have a government. We have our governments, and almost all of them in Western Europe, they are supportive of a Nazi movement. And it's not a Nazi movement which is contemporary. It's a Nazi movement which started in the 1930s and which collaborated with Nazi Germany and which were involved in killing in Ukraine up to 1 million Jews. Now, I don't want this. That of course is important, but every single component of these wars have an element of killing civilians. And killing civilians is illegal in terms of international law. Okay, I mean, you were in Kuala Lumpur on various occasions, and what happened in Kuala Lumpur is that we had the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal had a judgment on war crimes in relation to the United States and Britain on the one hand, and in relation to Israel. And we know that we were infiltrated. There was a sabotage that took place. But again, I don't know of a single war you're talking about genocide in at the end of World War II. All the German cities literally liquidated. I've checked. I was in Nuremberg a few years ago. Quite a few years ago, but they showed me. I said, did they target any military bases in Nuremberg? He said, no, they didn't. They targeted all the civilian areas, and the military bases were left intact. That was a U.S. project, U.S. British project, and the same thing with the bombing of urban areas in Tokyo. So the thing is that there's a very famous quote by George W. Bush. He says, I can't imitate his accent, he said, when you're talking about war, you're really talking about peace. Now, that is the substance of this decision of the U.S. Congress. It's presented as a peace project. And Biden actually plagiarizes George W. Bush. He says exactly the same. Said, well, we have a peace project. Now, the peace project is in support of the killings in Palestine. But then it is the support of a Nazi movement which killed more than 100,000 people in Ukraine, together with Nazi Germany. And so that historical element is absolutely crucial. I mean, why is it that they're hiding why is it that in Japan they're not talking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? How is it? Or Oppenheimer, for that matter. So it boggles the mind. I mentioned that people are now sort of, and that's our media, but that's also our politicians, that they used to have this, 2 minutes to midnight or whatever. Now, that was the atomic bulletin. Now, the atomic bulletin was actually part of the Manhattan Project. It was founded under the Manhattan Project in the wake of World War II. It's been there, always advising people of the dangers of nuclear war. They were even advising of the dangers of nuclear war before the arms race. But the latest statements that they made are literally on ridicule. And if I recall correctly, it was the statement by Mary Robinson, former president of the Republic of Ireland, and I'm of Irish descent, despite my awkward Slavic name. But she said, she identified, I don't have it in front of me, that essentially that there's several threats and there's a crisis. And she started comparing CO2 emissions to nuclear radiation, nuclear war. Now, that is a way of saying, and I'm sure she actually believes in it. And that's what is dangerous, that they're going around and say, well, you know, nuclear war, but there are other dangers. I mean, there's lockdown, COVID, and so on. And then, of course, there's climate change, and people are neglecting their green gas house emissions, and then they're presenting them as comparable. They're not comparable to any nuclear war is not comparable at this stage. There are other methods of weapons of mass destruction, admittedly. I won't get into that, but it's how you present the dangers. So there, incidentally, just another thing. There was something also very significant in the wake of World War II. Was Winston Churchill's the unspoken plan to wage war on Russia. And it happened he formulated at the beginning of 1945. And that was before Yalta, before the meetings. They had meetings in Potsdam and Yalta. But he formulated a plan, it was a British plan, to wage war on the Soviet Union. When the war was still ongoing in Nazi Germany. Now that again, that's another element. And then if you go further back, and that's also very important, is that you had in the 1930s the support of Wall Street, the Bank of England, and the Federal Reserve. They were supportive of Adolf Hitler's election campaign. They gave him money. Now that is corroborated. That is corroborated. So that there were a lot of American interests in Nazi Germany in the military context and also in infrastructure and science and so on. And they supported, the country was indebted to Wall Street. They were the creditors, and in many regards, the Third Reich would not have emerged as it had emerged without U.S. support. And that included the Bush family. That's another matter. But then there was another element, is that Operation Barbarossa would not have occurred had it not been for the supply of petrol, gasoline. You can't wage a war of that size without gasoline, and Nazi Germany didn't have it. They had some from Romania and so on, but they did not have oil. And they bought the oil from Standard Oil of New Jersey, and that those deliveries of oil were up until 1945. So that in effect, the United States could have put an end to that campaign against the Soviet Union at a much earlier period by simply curbing the supply of oil to the Third Reich. So that's the parenthesis. And incidentally, the Dulles brothers were present at that meeting. I mean, there were members from the. It was discreet in some regards, but the Wall Street didn't hide itself from actually supporting supporting Nazi Germany. So we have to broaden our understanding of history, which is very, very complex. But I still think, of course, that the situation in regards to the nuclear weapon at this particular juncture is very, very dangerous, and that also goes for Russia. Okay, and in some regards, Russia has a far more sophisticated nuclear weapons program in terms of delivery and so on. But this is why it is absolutely essential that we have peace initiatives, not protest. Protest is absolutely useless. I mentioned the fact that we have all these Western governments, which are, in a sense, complicit in supporting Nazi Germany, the two Ukrainian parties. They are complicit in the Holocaust in many regards, because they're supporting a group which was involved in the Holocaust. And that is a crime against humanity under national and international law. And that is something that people who are in the peace movement should understand. We don't simply say, please, would you stop bombing Gaza? No. You have to question their legitimacy as heads of state and heads of government. Now, it just so happens that the same governments which are supporting Israel intimating that the protest movement is anti-Semitic, they are supporting the Nazi movement, which was involved in the Holocaust. We should sort of look into these dimensions. You can't be saying we support Israel because people worldwide are protesting and they're anti-Semitic. No, of course, that many Jews are also involved in this endeavor. It's worldwide, but the thing is, one has to then question the legitimacy of the decision makers at different levels. It's not solely at the level of governments. It's also at the level of the groups which are behind the governments, and particularly the economic financial groups which behind the war is good for business, is it not?
It certainly is. And in fact, that is one of the interesting aspects of the article that struck me when I was reading it, is that, of course, we would expect, because war is good for business, we would expect that the prostitutes in the establishment media that are beholden to their corporate interests would stick up for those interests, as you document here in this article, pointing, for example, to the Globe and Mail that NATO deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, or Business Insider, three reasons why America's massive nuclear arsenal actually makes the world safer, or Washington Post, in the long run, wars make us safer and richer. As I say, that's to be expected, given where the funding for those media outlets comes from. But it's interesting to see the way that any real sense of an anti-nuclear peace movement could be actually started is derailed even from within the ranks, so to speak, of organizations like the Doomsday Clock, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, as you point out, the chair of the Doomsday Clock elders, trying to equate carbon emissions and pandemic preparedness to the issue of nuclear war is on its face ridiculous, but only serves to undermine the formation of a valid peace movement. So let's wrap up this conversation on that point in particular. Given the abject failure of any sort of anti-war movement to even question the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, or to derail or in any way stop or deflect the invasion and occupation of Iraq, or the fact that it completely went to sleep once Obama was elected and there was no protest whatsoever about Libya or Syria or any of the other crimes of aggression that have been waged around the world in recent years. And now that we see the U.S. Congress is continuing to fund billions and billions and billions of dollars into their proxy war in Ukraine with seemingly very, very little pushback from any side, what is the prospect for a valid, real anti-war movement that could even bring attention to the issue of the nuclear threat, let alone actually derail it?
Well, that's a very difficult question, because the whole political apparatus is criminalized, so to speak. And in the United States, it's both parties, okay? And that means that they are caving in. They're not caving in to the Zionist lobby. The Zionist lobby is an instrument of business of the financial establishment. Okay, I mean, some people think that the Zionist lobby and the ideological elements is what is guiding geopolitics. Not. I mean, we know in history the wars of religion going back to the antiquity. But what I think people have to understand first, they must recognize the dangers. And mind you, I must say the war is very, very broad in terms of weapons of mass destruction, because there's economic warfare. Okay, you simply hike up the price of fuel. There we are, and people are driven into poverty, but it's the same people, it's the same powerful business interests which are manipulating the price of fuel and the price of electricity and natural gas on the one hand, and which are hiking up the interest rates and triggering inflation, which impoverishes people worldwide. So that's an instrument of warfare. But at the same time, first of all, people have to acquaint themselves with the nature of nuclear war. And unfortunately, you have to dig around, because the media doesn't cover it. And if they do cover it, they'll start saying, well, they might be using it against Iran. But the thing is, it's also the question of legitimacy of this of these politicians, even though the politicians are not the ones who decide. The politicians are corrupt. They're paid to obey orders coming from up somewhere else. Now, I've been looking into the issue of And that's something which economists don't look at all. They now what's happening in Ukraine is the privatization of an entire country. And the privatization of an entire country comes with the portfolios, the BlackRock. Well, BlackRock has signed an agreement with Zelensky. And it's BlackRock and it's JP Morgan Chase. And it's the portfolio is a composite. In a foregone era, we had the IMF and the World Bank come in and impose conditionalities. Well, they don't do that anymore. Well, they do it, but it's not done in the same way. Now the portfolio comes in and said, we're going to help you and build your economy. And essentially, they are privatized. Ukraine is being privatized, and that is why they want to have a second option. Okay, I noticed that Mike Whitney has analyzed that. Is that there's a second option is really to spread it out as long as possible, because they cannot win that war. But they can use it to confront Russia. That's happening with NATO troops, which are stationed in Ukraine, which is in violation of international law in effect. And at the same time, they create conditions for the extensive appropriation of the wealth of a relatively large country, Ukraine, and they're building a whole series of ideological. They'll never come up and say we're supporting the Nazis. Now, that's absolutely obvious. They're supporting the Nazis. You can just look where the key positions are, and they are also supporting again a form of racism which is directed towards the Russian population of Ukraine, against the Jews, the minorities, and so on. It is a neo-Nazi ideology going back to World War II. But the thing is, How do we build a peace movement? Well, we have to also understand that acts of Nord Stream is an act of war as well. Nord Stream was an act of war, but it was an act of war against the European Union. And particularly, I mean, from a legal standpoint, it went through the territorial waters of several members of the European Union. And it was it immediately led to the hike up of energy prices in Europe, which is devastating. So there is also we've seen a lot on Nord Stream, but you just have to look at Biden's press report, well, his press conference, together with the Chancellor of Germany, Scholz. And he said, we're going to do it. He said, we're going to do it. He said, it's openly, we're going to blow up Nord Stream. Now, you don't need, of course, people forget that, but I have the exact text. He said, we're going to do it. They won't, we'll blow it up. And so that is an act of warfare against the European Union. And now you have a situation where the German economy is totally destabilized as a result of this of conditions which are set by dominant economic. They're not solely U.S. interests. It's the dominant Western interests in which are involved.
I Well, Michelle, given that it is a multi-trillion dollar armaments industry with all of the things, all of the various industries that feed into that industry, and given the fact that war is the health of the state, perhaps the idea of cracking the puzzle here and solving the problem of how to affect and generate a genuine anti-war movement will not be solved in the course of our conversation. But I will suggest, if people are interested in the topic, that they go back to a report that I filed for Global Research TV back in 2013, which, speaking of the specter of that Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal that you mentioned, that you participated in, that I attended over a decade ago, I'll point people back to my interview with former Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, in which he talked about his idea of not dismissing, not mocking and ridiculing and dismissing the principles that were supposedly enshrined in international law with the Nuremberg and Tokyo trials, but to push them through to their logical conclusion and actually criminalize war, which sounds like an off the wall, what an amazing idea, but in fact would go a lot farther towards the idea of actually stopping this war planning than anything else that is on the table. So if people are interested in that, I will suggest they go back through the GRTV archives to that interview in particular. But Michelle, we have covered an awful lot of information today, so I think I would just like to refer people back again to this article and hope that people in the audience will take the time to read it and share it with others who you think might be interested in this material. The article is, again, entitled The Hiroshima-Nagasaki Dress Rehearsal, Oppenheimer and the U.S. War Document Secret, September 15th, 1945, Doomsday Blueprint to Wipe the Soviet Union Off the Map. Once again, I will link that in the show notes for today's conversation. But I think we'll leave this here today. I'm sure we will be able to return to this topic in the future. Michelle Chossadovsky, thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Delighted to be with you.